We have Jeff Dice with us. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey, David. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. And, of course, the big topic everybody's excited about right now, people who are news junkies, is what's going on. We're going to have a debate tonight, huh? President Trump and Joe Biden going at it.
Well, you know, you mentioned markets and pricing, and the question is, is politics part of that? Is politics part of the marketplace? That there's a whole school of thought called public choice that says we ought to view political actors like Trump and Biden the same way we view economic actors like a private company, in the sense that they're not always rational, they're self-interested, they're not just purely motivated by the good of society or whatever. So look, I don't know if you saw any of the aborted Leslie Stahl 60 Minutes interview with Trump, but the whole thing now is pretty useless. I think I like the idea of direct media, where somebody wants to run for office, they can just talk to us. We don't need these sort of staged pageants where some dopey network trots out George Stephanopoulos or Wolf Blitzer or, you know, Mike Wallace's kid, Chris Wallace, I guess. You know, and then we don't need the sham intermediary of CNN or any of these people. That, to me, is what the digital age is all about, for good or bad. You know, sometimes not having a middleman is bad because, you know, people who really don't deserve a platform nonetheless get one by pandering to the lowest common denominator. But nonetheless, this is where we are, and, you know, I don't put any stock in these debates. They've really just become exercises in not hurting yourself. You know, it's all about what you don't say or do, and I probably haven't watched one in at least 10 years, because to me they're just almost unbearable. And you know, we've got all of our millions of people on social media to fill us in the next morning if anything actually happens.
Right. Well, what do you, you know, I think that the debate moderators and the 60 minute journalists and so forth, they are the equivalent of the referee in a pro wrestling match, aren't they? You know, a lot of people who even believe that wrestling is fake, probably if you asked them, they'd say, yeah, I guess there's a referee that's like doing rules. And it's like, no, that's the actor too. He's there to sell you on the legitimacy of the game, of this performance, right?
Right. Right. And, you know, the thing is it's, but they're not just actors. They are overwhelmingly on the side of Biden.
Right.
And if you ask journalists, honestly, 80-90% of them voted for Hillary Clinton against Trump, mm-hmm. and will vote for Joe Biden against Trump. That's just a fact. They can have whatever politics they want, and they can have whatever profession they want. That's fine. But there's a difference between opinion and reporting. There's a difference between editorializing and journalism. And that's fine. You know, I want to be clear here. If the overwhelming bulk of journalists are against Trump, that is absolutely fine. What's not fine is the pretense of objectivity. Mm-hmm. They hate this guy. They want him out. They will do almost anything to help that happen in terms of downplaying bad Biden stories and amplifying bad Trump stories. We've seen it time and time again, and it's just—I don't know about you, David, but it's just got me worn out.
Yeah.
I'm exhausted by it. I find the whole process way too much. These campaigns are too long, and honestly, what I really resent is the idea that if you don't vote for our guy, there'll be trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's a form of demoralization where they say, look, we've got the American public so beat up with COVID and job losses and racial strife and all this, you know, this acrimony and animosity surrounding Trump. It's almost like they want you to cry uncle and say, okay, let's have Biden. Anything to give us 6 months of normalcy or whatever it takes. And that is not in keeping with the, you know, democracy these guys are endlessly claiming to view as somehow sacred. So they're not really Democrats, small d. What they are is people who want to use democracy, mass democracy, at the ballot booth when it works, when it, you know, forwards their purposes. When it doesn't, when Trump wins, then they start to change the rules.
Yeah, Jam Online says, much love for Jeff. Brand Without Claws says, Trump is just as bad, but I'm going to vote for him. And I think a lot of people are just, Americans don't like being pushed around and told you have to do something. Now, some of them do, obviously, where they put their mask on while they hike in a deserted forest. But there's a large portion of Americans that don't like being told by like 90% of people, you do what we tell you or we're going to smack you, we're going to make you feel bad, we're going to push you in the corner, we're going to dox you if you do anything. People don't like that. Americans like underdogs, and the media's strong arm tactics to try to get you on their character that they want to be the hero, it's going to backfire if they hadn't done that, I think.
Yeah, it's true. And there's a reason why voting is anonymous, or at least ostensibly anonymous. We hope it's anonymous. It's anonymous because you're supposed to be able to vote for whom you want to without having to worry about your neighbor's prying eyes. But, you know, as far as the underdog goes, it's a little strange because in many ways Trump, his personality is anything but. You know, he's not Michael Dukakis. He's not Jimmy Carter. But the problem with this scenario, and I certainly took more of an interest in Trump versus Hillary Clinton than Trump versus Biden, because I just thought that was a more interesting sociological phenomenon because of the inevitability of Hillary. The progressive arc was that, of course, we're going to have Hillary Clinton. We just had our first black president. Now we're going to have our first female president, and so on and so forth. And so when Trump came along, that was an earthquake. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, I hate to say it, but he doesn't really deserve re-election in the sense that he didn't, in any significant way, get us out of the Middle East, and he didn't, in any significant way, drain the swamp. He stayed too susceptible to flattery, and that's why there were people around him, like John Bolton. That's why there were people around him still, like Fauci. I hesitate to become emotionally invested in this at all, and I would suggest the same for your listeners because there's not all that much he can do in office, which we've seen over the last 4 years. And as bad as Biden is, and I think he's a lot worse than advertised, I think he's far more left-wing in his heart of hearts, and also I think he's far more corrupt than the sort of down-the-center, long-serving senator, you know, image he projects. But, they're going to put the pedal to the metal whether Trump wins or loses. In other words, they don't just go away. So I'm more into figuring out how we can live together through some form of succession or federalism or subsidiarity than I am in figuring out how to, you know, just barely beat back the leftist tide every 4 years.
Sir Online says, I think the case can be made that Trump is providing the foundation on which future radical decentralization can be made. And I think if there's a battle between globalism and nationalism, I guess nationalism is closer to home than globalism, isn't it? Right?
Well, certainly. And look, if Trump manages to win, you know, the first time you could call it a fluke, you could say Hillary Clinton was asleep, assuming she would win easily, didn't go into Wisconsin and some of the swing states as heavily as she should have. People were more upset about the economy than pollsters understood, you know, that sort of thing. But if he wins again, then if he wins a second time, it's no fluke. And then I think you're going to have a very real scenario where states like California are simply saying, we are not going to follow the edicts of the federal government. We are simply going to ignore, immigration edicts, or we're going to have our own minimum wage, or we're going to have our own gun laws, you know, that sort of thing. So I really view that as the most positive scenario that could come out of this. Not that we're going to have the kind of federal government I would like us to have, which is not much, but rather we could see the animosity and what in the left's eyes the illegitimacy of Trump turn into something that's actually helpful for us, which is to break up and go our separate ways.
Yeah, so when you see that, when you see that kind of animosity, do you think that the media would be as losing their minds about Trump if he did everything he's done in office, but he didn't do any of the gruff stuff, the mean stuff, the calling them out directly, mocking them, making fun of them? If he had done absolutely zero of that, no braggadocio, he does all the same policies, but none of the politically incorrect stuff. What do you think? Do you think they'd hate him as much as they do?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I don't think he would have won, because that was his whole charm, right? That he was something totally different. And that's what a country that was fed up wanted. But, let's say he had won. I think the answer is no. I don't think there's a ton of actual enacted policy differences between what Donald Trump has done and what Hillary Clinton would have done. And I'm not talking about tone, substance, style, rhetoric. I'm talking about actually enacted policies, given the realities of a divided House and Senate, et cetera. So I don't think, she would have done all that much different in the Middle East. I don't think she would have done all that much different with respect to taxes or anything else. I mean, maybe a little bit. So this is all about a sort of a personal, visceral hatred of Donald Trump. And I think if Hillary Clinton were president right now, the entire story about COVID, with the exact same facts, the same data, the same number of deaths, the same origins, the same talk about vaccines and distancing and masks and all that, I think the story as reported would be remarkably different, because I think the media would be going, working 24/7 to portray Hillary Clinton as the brave leader who was, commanding the federal government to keep us safe from this virus. If she had done exactly what Donald Trump has done with respect to international flights and if you can remember way back, everyone was talking about ventilators. And
yeah.
So I think that there's no question about that, that she would have been treated differently.
Yeah, what I don't understand about the media is maybe you can enlighten me. What are they actually saying that Trump didn't do enough? Like, I don't get it. I guess he didn't. He spent all this money. He was doing the commandeering of the economy, was moving ventilators this way and military boats and all this stuff. I mean, as far as statist intervention goes, what did he do what did he not do enough of? I don't understand it. I don't get their criticism.
Well, and that's just it. These are the same critics who were calling him an authoritarian fascist. And if he had shut down international flights into the United States, you'd think they would lose their minds. But instead, they're saying he didn't do enough, or he didn't do soon enough, or he didn't send enough money, or he didn't. I love the fact that he never attempted nor suggested federal mandates, whether that's masks, distancing, school shutdowns, business shutdowns. He, from the get-go, never tried to use his bully pulpit as president to boss around the governors. So he deserves a lot of credit for that. And as a result, we got to see a little bit of an experiment right here at home between the 50 states. And we're still watching that unroll, and I'm thankful for that. So this, the media is just full of it. They, no matter what this guy did, they were going to absolutely savage him. And that's a big reason why nobody wants to listen to them when it comes to this election.
Now, I want to go back to something you said earlier, that you think we need to move, of course, in a decentralized direction and looking closer to home for political solutions and situations to occur. You were talking about we need to start getting along not under the same roof, right? If you have a best friend, but if you have to live into the same house and have the same thermostat, that best friend might not like you very much after all, right? And that's kind of the idea you're saying. We need to kind of go closer to home and stop having everything decided by a centralized government, right?
Well, if you look at countries that are, at least before COVID, relatively happy and relatively high functioning, they tend to be small. 330 million people forced to live under one central federal government, and really oftentimes under just the whims of four or five Supreme Court justices who are effectively making laws. I mean, let's be honest, it's a recipe for disaster. And if you look at big countries like China and India, which are even larger than the United States but have one central government, they tend to have a lot of turmoil. You know, states that are prosperous and happy tend to look more like Sweden and Liechtenstein and Switzerland. So there's a reason for that. And part of the reason, you know, there's a lot of factors. We can't be simpletons. But a lot of that is just size. And so the idea that, you know, we can somehow muster up, let's say, 75 million, votes for our guy or gal every 4 years, it's just silly. So I think the writing's on the wall. Some of these political differences are far more cultural than they are policy, and we ought to just recognize them and say we don't need one size fits all. And that doesn't mean we have to break up and have outright secession and new governments form, but it does mean we have to try a much stronger degree of federalism.
So what would you say to folks that say, well, you know, wouldn't China love that? Wouldn't China love to see a couple states break apart? Wouldn't that be making us weak, and then China or somebody would come in and try to reap the chaos or something?
Well, is China trying to reap the chaos in Switzerland or Sweden? I'm not sure. I mean, look, China has its own problems. I mean, what matters is how wealthy you are per capita, not how wealthy you are just in terms of gross GDP, which is pretty much a meaningless number anyway. So that's what this is all about. It's all about quality of life and prosperity and peace. And what we're doing right now is creating the conditions for a civil war. And so there's nothing worse, nothing more important to avoid than an outright hot civil war. So if breaking up sounds radical to you, or if it sounds like something that the Chinese would be secretly thrilled by because they would become relatively that much more powerful on the world stage or something like that, I mean, those are secondary questions. We have a cancer, and we have to deal with that first.
Jeff, I want to go to something closer to culture. Actor Chris Pratt, he found himself the target of the Mean Girls. You know, have you ever seen that movie Mean Girls, Jeff, where they're always talking crap about people? That's all they ever do?
Well, they certainly have found their place on social media, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, that's like the heart and soul of the modern neo-lib left, is they just mob people. And the guy didn't even say anything. And you wrote an article about it called The Privilege of Politics. Maybe can you expand a little bit the story?
Well, what I know about Chris Pratt is basically through my son, because I got a 15-year-old who's into the Avengers. I hope I'm not wrong about that, the Avengers series he's in. But so, you know, I've seen him in some movies, taking my son. And so basically, some of his fellow actors who were very left, pro-Biden, somehow it was brought up to their attention, A, that Chris Pratt has not said anything about Biden and that he may be a secret Trump supporter, and B, that he attends some sort of Christian church, which according to the social media enforcers is not sufficiently up to snuff with respect to their view on LGBT. And so one of his fellow actors, a guy named Mark Ruffalo, who is, I believe, quite a left-wing person, came to his defense and said, no, I know Chris. I've worked with him. He's a great guy. He's a kind, loving person and not at all political. So this was what really triggered people, because all of a sudden the mob came out and said, well, this is a privilege. He's a rich white guy, and his church is anti-LGBT, and it's easy for him to sit back and watch Trump get reelected. But the rest of us, this is life or death, because Trump is a Nazi fascist, and he's going to kill LGBT, you know, this sort of thing. Just an absolute farce of an outraged mob. So it turns out, I did a little digging, and it turns out, of course, that his church is not some radical right-wing fundamentalist church. It's a pretty mainline, Bible church, and they assiduously deny any anti-LGBT sentiment. They're just like, look, we welcome anyone in our church. And, you know, it just struck me that, first of all, think of the privilege. The real privilege is not Chris Pratt minding his own business and being a good guy and going to the church of his choice. Okay, that's not privilege. He's not harming anyone. The privilege is insisting there's some affirmative duty on the behalf of Chris Pratt or us, David Gornosky and Jeff, to sort of go out there and not only accept these people's politics, which is, you know, Biden, you have to vote Biden because Trump is an existential threat, and really we need Bernie, but, you know, we'll have to settle for Biden. And then number two, it's not, you know, you can't sit by silently and your, you know, your church better conform to the latest, and I would say ever-changing, requirements of the LGBT orthodoxy on, let's say, the issue of transgenderism. Well, you know, churches are allowed to have doctrine, and churches view all kinds of things as sins. They might view adultery and smoking cigarettes or watching porn or whatever as a sin, but the people who engage in those things and who are deemed sinners are still allowed to come on Sundays, and everyone's friendly. This, I think, was just anti-Christian bias coming through. But more importantly, the idea that you have to view life through a purely political lens, like these crazy leftists do, and if you don't, it's because you're privileged, you're white, or you're rich, and you're going to be a-okay if Trump wins, but the marginalized people are going to be, you know, put in concentration camps or something. I mean that is privilege to boss people around and say, not only do you have to agree with my politics and accept my politics, but you have an affirmative duty to go out there and pursue them just as actively as I do. You can't just have a quiet life where you don't view everything through a political lens. And that really galls me. I think that's wrong, and I think it's un-American.
Well, Jeff, just to illustrate the lie of their whole argument that they stand for victims, yesterday on this program, we got to break the news with Alice Marie Johnson, the woman who was pardoned by President Trump. She was put in prison for laws by the Biden. And, you know, Biden put that crime bill on the books for nonviolent crimes. Trump pardoned her. And we got to break the news with her on my show yesterday that a guy who's called into the show from prison to plead for clemency, John Bolin, he had a first-time nonviolent drug offense. He had 4 back-to-back life sentences, Jeff. Meanwhile, people who are violent, they get off scot-free. But he was serving 4 back-to-back life sentences for a nonviolent crime. He got clemency from President Trump. So the reality is, Jeff, is that Trump and whatever we want to say, they're actually doing more to undo the criminal justice, mass incarceration that the left has been the architects of. So I really appreciate you coming on, Jeff, and it's always a pleasure to hear from you.
All right. Thanks, David.
And make sure you check out Mises.org. That's Mises, M-I-S-E-S.org. I'm David Bernofsky. Godspeed.